Nehemiah 6, verse 3. I sent messengers to them with this reply, I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? It's extraordinary, this book of Nehemiah. There we are, from the 5th century BC. Contemporary, this man, with Plato, who's one of the cleverest men that this world has ever seen. And, of course, you know, today Plato is erudite reading for esoteric minority of people. Much valued. But Nehemiah is populist reading for the whole world. He is read on every continent because he's in the Bible. And then we must say to ourselves, I suppose, what are we doing in a great modern city like this, coming in to a church to listen to Nehemiah being read? What has he got to say to me? Has he got anything particularly for me? As we look at it, I think what comes to me through that sentence there, verse 3, and through this passage, is the whole theme of a man who is single-minded. That's what's stabbing itself through to me. Single-mindedness, and that does speak to our world. The one thing that you are doing with your life, with your energies, with your loves, your aspirations, and everything. That's the question. You can find, of course, examples of that from many walks of life. Jack Nicklaus, the great world champion golfer, was once asked how he was able to stand up to the pressures of professional golf, you know, the crowds and the hazards and the bunkers and the publicity, everything. He replied, I'm quoting, "When I leave one green, a flash comes up in my mind and I see the next hole filmed for me. I see my drive, where it is going to land." He goes on, "Then when I have played that hole, the next hole comes up on the new film, so that as I walk onto that tee to play the hole and I put the ball on the tee, I don't just see the golf ball. I see the little number on the golf ball. And all I see as I prepare to hit that golf ball is the number on the ball and the place where I'm going to hit it. Crowds are out. The hazards are out. The weather is out. The newspaper, television and radio are out. Everything except that number on the golf ball and the place that I'm going to hit it." So when we take a person like Nehemiah, yeah, he epitomizes all of that. One great thing to do. I've been given a great project. And here is somebody who had been butler to the most important and most powerful man in the world, Artaxerxes, who was the top man in the Persian Empire. And to be the butler to the emperor of Persia didn't mean just you were serving the drinks. You meant that you were the majordomo of the household. You were in charge of the arrangements. So to be that, to be butler to the king of Persia, was a very important post. You say, well, you know who he is, butler to the king of Persia. But no longer. He's not a butler, he's now a builder. And he's building a wall at that. What did he know about wall building? He knows enough about it to get it done in 52 days flat with his friends. The walls of Jerusalem, have you ever seen them? They are enormous. Of course, I know that they're not exactly the identical walls that Nehemiah was building. So they've been flattened and rebuilt and flattened and rebuilt, time without number. Nevertheless, he was building a wall for a city. Not just so that it could be a city, a decent city, but it could be harboring the center of God's mission to the world. That's what he was there for. Here is somebody then who I see in this passage who was sharpened by pressure in getting his priorities straight. Sharpened by pressure. The pressure comes again, and he's turned up earlier in our studies, of course, in this man, this snake, Sanballat, verse 1, and Tobiah and Geshem, an unholy three, who are always trying to get Nehemiah off course, to get him to lay down the project and forget it, or to be diverted from it. They don't want it to happen. Partly because Sanballat was from the north, he was from Samaria, And he didn't want to see a rival show there, down in the south, in Jerusalem. Didn't want to see that happen at all. He probably had syncretistic elements also in his mindset. So he really wasn't of the same kind of faith as Nehemiah and his friends. Not really. So he's something of a dissentient voice. And therefore he'll do anything to stop the project. And he has tried already in our studies. He's trying again. What is he doing? He's saying, verse 2, look, come, let's meet together in one of the villages, the plain of Ono. Shall we just meet just for a conference? A day conference won't do any harm. Out in the plain, there were 27 miles northwest of Jerusalem, the plain of Ono, and it was in neutral territory. It wasn't really Jewish territory. It wasn't anything particularly. It was neutral, no man's land. He said, let's come and have a place, time together, discussion in alien territory. A conference. No. I'm not going to do it. He's sharpened by the pressure. The pressure only makes him that much more committed to the task. And it says here that the invitation is repeated four times. Four times, verse 4. They sent me the same message. Each time I gave them the same answer. No, I'm not coming. And the fifth time, they then sent an unsealed letter, which means it was an open letter to him, conveying the threats of the rumors that had been put around, and the rumors in the letter, and of course they intended to be opened by the messengers, because it's an open letter, so that people will get to know what the gist of it is that, of course, Nehemiah is guilty of a plot against his former boss, and who is still his boss, really, Artaxerxes, the king of Persia. He wants to set himself up as king. He wants to have a rival regime. So that's the word that's being put around. Well, Nehemiah is sharpened by all of this, so that he's able to get to the point of saying in verse 8, I sent in this reply, nothing like what you are saying is happening. You are just making it up out of your head. And he observes they were trying to frighten us, saying their hands will get too weak for the work and it'll not get completed. It was very nearly completed. By this time next week in our studies, it will be completed. All but just the gates, a few things had to be put in place and it would be done. And they're still trying to get them off course. I suppose the gates are the most important part of what all really to get done. Here they are, trying to keep them away from getting it done. In Pilgrim's Progress, John Bunyan has that great hero of his story, of course, Christian. And again, people are trying to get him off course on his way to the celestial city. And at one point in the story, he's accosted by a certain Demas himself, who's only one of countless people who are trying to get Christian diverted. And Demas invites the intrepid traveler to come and see a certain silver mine that he's got. Christian's reply is memorable. I'm quoting from John Bunyan. What thing so deserving as to turn us out of the way? So he's got one great course to set, Christian. I'm on my way to the celestial city. I'm not going to get diverted. Here is Nehemiah saying, I'm on my course to put together the walls that will enshrine God's mission to the world, God's statement to the world, a light to the nations and to the Gentiles. So why should the work stop while I come down to you? I'm not coming. And why should I be put off by the threats of the open letter? I'm not going to be put off. Again, later on in this same passage, the attempt comes from a different quarter in verse 10. But then we read that from the day he went to the house of Shemaiah, who is shut in, and he says, let us meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you. By night they are coming to kill you. So, shall we have a meeting? Exactly the same. Let's have a meeting. This time, not in alien territory, but in familiar territory. Let's meet in the temple that's been set up. Let's meet there. We need to help you. You're under threat. He's not going to be turned aside from that. He realizes that it's all part of the plot to get him away from the work. So he's sharpened by pressure. Matter of fact, whenever anything good is being attempted in our world, you can be quite sure that somebody will try and pull it down. It doesn't take long. When I was, I am chairman of African Enterprise. There's a lot of Christian work in Africa. I'm UK chairman of African Enterprise. And on the day that Idi Amin, the dictator, fell from power in Uganda those years ago, our African Enterprise organization decided it had to send in a convoy of aid to help the country, which was in really rather a state of chaos. So we were sending in a convoy of bandages and blankets for refugees and foodstuffs, milk powder for the children, medicines, great convoy. We were the first convoy in after the change of the regime. You know what the second convoy was? It was from the Soviet Union. You know what was in the convoy? Packed with guns. And we thought to ourselves then, you know, you're only going to try and do one good thing, and evil will follow hard on the heels. It doesn't take long. Jesus comes into our world, and immediately the agents of the kingdom of darkness are hard on to try and get him off course. So we mustn't be surprised when there is pressure. You and I mustn't be surprised when we see some of the banner headlines. Dismayed, maybe. Maybe we weep over some of the things that happen, but not surprised. Let's believe that we will be sharpened. When the pressures are on in business standards around us, we shouldn't be too surprised. Or if you find it in your own faith as a Christian, if you are a Christian so far, that you find that the opposition is hard on you from your associates or your neighbors, or your family, it's actually quite a good sign. It's not a bad sign. It's very normal. You should take it as a very confirming sign that you are on the right track if you find that there are those who are coming against you because of your Christian beliefs. It's a good sign, not a bad sign. Here it simply sharpens up Nehemiah. Oh, I'm going on. No, I see that as a diversion. I'm going on. You're not going to be intimidated. So maybe that's the first main point we can entertain from our passage. And the second main point is that here is a man who is sharpened by pressure, first of all, but secondly, focused by priorities. The great priority. What is it? Why, there it is again. Let's look at our main sentence. I am carrying on a great project. Cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? He's focused by that priority. It's a calling. God has called him to this work. And Artaxerxes, the king, has let him go with his blessing to do it and leave off being the butler to the king. We could have said, you know, well, what would Nehemiah be best known for in later life? After he's dead, what will he be known for? Surely people at that time would have said, oh, he was a great butler. Fantastic. He was butler to the king of Persia. Served fantastic drinks, put on marvelous banquets. He put on a huge show. He was a great butler. No, he's not known for that at all. He's known as a builder who got the walls of Jerusalem up in 52 days. What will you be best known for, you and I, when we're dead, when we're gone? What would people say about us? Well, they were noted before. What would it be? When there's a calling from God, nothing should divert us. That priority will be our focus point of life. Whatever our calling. I'm a preacher, a pastor, I'm an evangelist as well. When I think of the man through whom my grandfather was converted many years ago, my grandfather was Tommy Buse. D.L. Moody was the man, the preacher from America, through whom Tommy became a Christian. And in San Francisco in the late 1880s, as one of D.L. Moody's great campaigns was about to begin, there was a professional photographer in the city of San Francisco, by the name of George Reimer. And he offered to take Moody's photograph. He wanted to add Moody to his collection of notables and actors and politicians and all the rest. And Moody declined with thanks. He declined the offer of a free sitting, saying that he had not come to San Francisco to have his photograph taken, but to save Ryman's soul. Ryman was beside himself with fury. But on the very last day of the campaign, Ryman and his wife turned up to the campaign. He said, let's go and see what all this is about. Okay, we'll just see this, just as a show. It led to him becoming a follower of Christ and then becoming himself a great preacher, George B. Ryman. So, you know, supposing Moody had said, okay, thanks, yeah, I'd like to have my photograph taken, thank you very much. Nothing would have happened. Moody was a man of tremendous single-mindedness. We're getting come here for one big thing. So as a result of that, Ryman himself, the photographer, becomes caught up in this whole wonderful thing. Focused by priorities. Or again, if I can take John Wesley's last letter, written to William Wilberforce over 200 years ago, February the 24th, 1791, just over 200 years ago. Last letter written to the great campaigner for the abolition of the slave trade, William Wilberforce, MP. Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God is with you, who can be against you? Oh, be not weary in well-doing. So that's the last thing that Wesley does. Write a letter to his friend saying, keep going. You've got a great thing, and unless God has called you for this, you'll be worn out. But if he's with you, what can stop you? Here is Nehemiah. God has sent him. He knows it. So the sense of calling has got to be with God's servants in whatever century they live. Here we are caught up in the life of a huge capital. What's going on around us? We're part of it. And what is our calling? Let's see if we can't sharpen that up as we look at Nehemiah, the great thing that we're meant to do in life. Oh, there'll be plenty of secondary objectives. But the great thing, why were we called? What are we here for? And the last little thing I'll just leave with you before we go to our sandwiches, very quickly, sustained by prayer. So he's sharpened by pressure, focused by priorities, last of all, sustained by prayer. Because we have those little prayers coming all the way through the book of Nehemiah. Here it is in second half of verse 9. He's been faced by the open letter. But I prayed, now strengthen my hands. It doesn't even say, oh God, please strengthen my hands. Just strengthen my hands. Nehemiah is noted for the brevity of his prayers. But they keep coming, little and often, little prayers. Do you pray? Do you walk into your place of work? Do you come up the steps and into the main entrance? It's a good idea. Let that be a moment of a one-sentence arrow prayer. This day for you. This day of adventure with Christ here on planet Earth. Another day with him. How can I spend it? How can I please you today? Sustained by prayer. So there it is again in verse 14. All of the things that are happening, the threats. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat. Oh my God. Because of what they've done. Remember also the prophetess Noadiah. She's part of the story. Part of the conspiracy. And the rest of the prophets who have been trying to intimidate me. An awful lot against him. But Nehemiah says, it doesn't matter. I'm committing it to God. I'm going on. So he goes on like a Duracell battery. And he keeps on, keeps going. Single-mindedness. Not a great butler, but an extraordinary builder. And he does it with God. What will we be most remembered for? Let's learn from Nehemiah. Let's pray. Let this passage, O Lord, rest in our minds. Help us to come back to it. And help us to see this great project that your servant Nehemiah was given to do. I'm carrying a great project and will not come down. Help us to see how we may best spend our lives for you and be spent for you. And help us to assist each other in the life of the kingdom. for your name's sake. Amen.